The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. I've had a week of homeschooling, folks, and I have had it up to here. Basically, the two children have been just on screens all the time. And it's really made me feel awful as a parent. And now I think back and I try and remember what did they play with before tablets? That's how long this week feels. I'm like, what did they do before? And I'm imagining like blocks with letters on it and like wooden horses or something. That doesn't seem right, but it feels like, what are the toys are there now? I hope you are managing better if you have young kids at home, but it's great to get the distraction of Future Proof every once in a while. We're speaking to a guy who's got a fantastic job. His name's Paul Jensen. He's a marine biologist, and he's looking at how we might get medicine from slime. Yes, really. But he's also spent time aboard the Nautilus, which is this amazing ship that live streams its missions. And it went on this one expedition where they managed to find this old whale carcass. And I was watching this live on Twitter, and we talked to Paul about it in the piece. It was just amazing. So I'm going to be talking to him about what life is like if you're a marine biologist. Before that, though, it is time to look back at some of the week's science news. And joining me via Skype are Dr. Ruth Freeman and Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome, folks. Our first story. Has to do with an ancient cave painting, which I have to say, Ruth, I've seen, you know, plenty of these over the years and usually gone, I could have done that. But this one's actually very good.
It is very good. And it's not just an ancient cave painting. It is the most ancient cave painting that's been found. And it's believed to be around 45,500 years old. So archaeologists from Indonesia and Australia found this painting a couple of years ago. And it's almost like a life-size representation of one very clear picture of a pig. And then possibly three or four other pigs are also in the painting. But you're right, they're painted in beautiful detail. And behind them are handprints, but the hands have been drawn using a human hand as a stencil. So the people obviously put their hands up against the wall of the cave, and they probably spat the paint onto the wall and then removed their hand, so leaving a blank space where their hand had been. It actually is a lovely piece of work. But I think what's so interesting about cave paintings is they're often used to look at the changes in human evolution. So different kinds of painting are associated with different human species. And, you know, as we've talked about before, there's been many different branches of the human line. And it's been a bit controversial because actually a couple of years ago, very, very old paintings were found in Europe. Now, they were painted at the time that the Neanderthals were there, when we know there weren't anatomically modern humans. But in fact, this new study is confirming that was probably a mistake. So really some of the interesting science here is around the dating that was being used for these paintings. So this painting is covered in calcium deposits, so little crusts all over the painting. And what the scientists were able to do is date those crusts, and those crusts are older than 45,500. They're 45,500 years old, and the painting is under them. So the painting is older than them. And that's a similar technique that was used in Spain to look at the Neanderthal paintings. But since that Spanish work, researchers have found that if you only take one or two samples, it's probably not that accurate, because the chemical that they're measuring, the compound, the element, in fact, uranium, can actually leach out accidentally. So here they used a very, very granular technique where they looked at layers of those deposits to make sure they picked ones where the uranium hadn't leaked out. So what this is showing us is this probably is actually older, and possibly those paintings in Spain are around the same age or younger, but were possibly not done by Neanderthals. So again, there's been a whole narrative here around sort of the cognitive and the mental capacity of different human lines. And that's why this is so interesting.
It is the most revisionist of all the sciences.
I mean, it is.
it's every week someone's saying they got it wrong. And actually, we can prove it with this. What age are we talking about, Ruth? Did you say how old this painting is?
Yeah, it's 45,500 years old. And one of the things that actually it wasn't, I couldn't find it in the actual journal paper, but I think it must have been in an interview with the scientists. They're hoping to try and extract DNA from the paint that was spat onto the wall, which seems like an incredible endeavor, because obviously that would be fascinating if they could actually get DNA from the people who spat onto the wall. But it's an amazing, and it's a beautiful painting, as
it
you said.
It is a beautiful painting. You can see it on our Twitter page, twitter.com/newstalkscience. Shane, our second story is a world away, and it's to do with a stepping stone to further space adventures.
Yeah, I've seen this story described as the first interplanetary petrol station, which is a great way of thinking about it. So there is a mission to return to the moon, and this space mission is led by NASA and ESA, the European Space Agency and its American equivalent. And this hopes to send humans back to the moon by 2024. And they will use the moon as a launch for a manned or personed mission to Mars. And so they need things, infrastructure on the moon and around the moon to make that happen. And so
there is no infrastructure on the moon. There's a few abandoned buggies, a flag, some footprints, and a few golf balls. And I think that's it.
And the retroreflector, which is a complex mirror system that reflects a laser that's shone at the moon, and it's able to tell us exactly how far the moon away is, and to prove that the moon is slowly getting away from us, about 3.5 centimeters a year. But I digress. So the Gateway lunar orbiter will whip around the moon like a space station. It is a space station. And this week, the European Space Agency have signed a multi-million euro contract to build a component of it, the petrol station component, called Esprit. It's incredible. It'll provide communications capacity and, as I said, fuelant. And of course, when you think about how does fuel work in space, I remember as an undergraduate, fuel. Is that, are they not the same words?
Are you overcomplicating the word fuel?
It might be, yeah. And I was about to give you some sort of like complicated thing about how Newton's third law works in space, right? Because like, how do you move off in space? You've nothing to push against.
Yeah.
I remember this confusing me a lot when I was a student. So what they do is they spit out fuel or fuelant from the back of the spacecraft, and that pushing against your own fuel is what propels things in space.
Which
incredible to think.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah. It's like firing a bullet and the bullet propelling the gun.
And so this is going to store fuel for further launches from the moon. Surely that's a way more complicated and a necessary step.
They will have lots of fuel up there, from xenon, which is an element, and other chemical compounds that are fuels. But I'm not sure how much they're going to send. And all I can assume is just basically using my physics cap on, is that it's far easier launch something from the moon than it is from the Earth. So if you're able to get the moon, if you're able to get the fuel to the moon, you can launch missions to Mars and other places with far less energy expenditure.
Our third story is actually almost a bit of a personal one, because it's reminiscent of a trip that we both took to Bali many, many years ago.
Yeah, there was a bit of post-traumatic stress reading this story, because we were victims of some thieving monkeys when we were visiting this temple in Bali. It's called the Uluwatu Temple, and it's a really famous tourist resort in Bali. But it's famous because it's inhabited by about 300 or 400 long-tailed macaques who are famous for stealing things from tourists when they go. And actually, this paper, when I started reading it, immediately reminded me of a very famous experiment with monkeys, which people might have seen, where you see monkeys learning to exchange tokens for food. And while tokens are being exchanged and they can see each other getting a token in exchange, they're very happy to be passed a token, and they will pass the token back and get a piece of cucumber in return. And they're very happy with that until they see maybe their neighbor in the cage beside them getting a grape or a better piece of food in return for the same token. And they will get very agitated when they see this. So we've known for years that animals, non-human primates, can recognize the value of a token, or they can start to associate value with something that doesn't have value itself. But this is the first study showing a wild population doing exactly that. So although these monkeys are clearly living in an environment that's been dominated and changed by humans, they're a fully wild population. And what they do, well, maybe to say what the researchers did, the researchers actually spent nearly 300 days filming the macaques at this temple and watching their interactions with the human visitors that came. And what they found was the monkeys weren't just stealing indiscriminately, that they could actually differentiate between the value of the items that they stole. And they were doing this by watching the people. So they were ascribing high value to things like glasses and mobile phones, and low value to things like an empty camera case, a plastic bottle of water, or a hairpin. So they quickly start, well, they have learned, actually not quickly, over generations, what are the things that humans value. So this was something that the guides had known for a long time, but the researchers were able to confirm that by their evidence. They also were able to identify every single monk or a group of monkeys individually with 100% accuracy. And they were able to start with those monkeys through some experimental tests, knowing what were their preferences. So what to them was a high value return. So these monkeys, they steal things, but they will give them back for food. And there's different kinds of food. They will give them back for eggs, for piece of fruit, for crackers, for these kind of things. But different monkeys like different things. And also some monkeys strike a harder bargain. And what they found was the older monkeys get better at these economic transactions. So it's really amazing. So that what they will see is the monkeys will get more food for a higher value item. They will hold out longer if they know what they have is valuable. And I think the fact that they were also able to associate this with age and experience it's a really advanced cognitive process in this wild species. And it shows a kind of cultural sophistication that probably we haven't seen before in a wild population.
Did the researchers say anything about finding Kate's sunglasses that were stolen by the monkeys?
I didn't notice that in the paper, okay. But...
Well, it was quite some time ago. Shane, our final story has to do with urine.
It does. And I should say that I've Googled it and feulent is not a word. Ah. So my secondary school English teacher, I'm sure if he's listening, will just be like, he hasn't changed. Yes, this final story is about recycling, the ultimate type of recycling, using urine to rot wood, and in that rotting release heat, and that heat can be used to do things. It's an absolutely incredible story. So urine was once widely used for many things. The Romans used it to degrease clothes in their laundries. And famously, it is used as a way to dye clothes. Scottish tweed being associated with the smell of urine when it gets wet. And this work from scientists in the Netherlands has looked at how urine can help wood to rot. And so basically they're looking to release the latent heat and in a different way to combustion. So it's compost rather than combustion. And what it does is basically is this, that there are chemicals in the urine that help to speed up the rotting. So when we put food into our compost bin, there's microbes and little bugs that live in there, and that breaks down the food. It doesn't work a lot with wood because there isn't sufficient nutrients for the little bugs to do their work. And that's what the urine does. It provides the nutrients. It's like a vitamin supplement for the little bugs to do their job, to break down the wood, and in doing so, release the latent heat. So when you're breaking the wood down, you're breaking chemical bonds, and that releases the energy from the bond and turns it into heat. And so you're talking about something like how much urine do we a day? It's probably liters of it. And that's just per person. So there's an incredible supply of urine. And when you think about how slowly the wood will rot, that's not a resource that's going to go away quickly either. So they know, and I read in the paper here that previous work of sort of composting wood has shown that you can sustain temperatures between 40 degrees and 55 degrees Celsius for quite a long time. And if you put that into something like a heat exchange, like a heat pump, that can keep a building warm. If you're able to improve the efficiency, it would also be sufficient to heat water. So, incredible. I wonder, like, would a family be able to produce enough urine to keep their own heat pump or heat exchange going? In other words, could your waste be the thing that keeps your house hot?
One day, Shane, we can only dream. We can only dream. Dr. Shane Bergen, Dr. Ruth Freeman, thank you very much. One of my screen highlights of 2019 was happening upon a live stream of scientists exploring the ocean on board the American research vessel, the Nautilus. I just came across it by complete chance, and it happened to be the exact time that the team came across the carcass of a whale on the sea floor. And there was a whole ecosystem living off it, and the scientists were commentating and taking samples, and you could see these crabs and squids and octopuses in HD just milling around this thing. It was fascinating, and it was amazing to watch. But these explorations aren't just for education. Many of the discoveries on board the Nautilus can actually lead to new medicines. Dr. Paul Jensen, who's professor at the Center for Marine Biotechnology and Biomedicine at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, joins me now. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Great to be here.
Before we talk about your work in trying to find new molecules, can you tell us a little bit about the Nautilus, the sort of missions that it undertakes, and what it's like being on board this really remarkable ship?
Yeah, sure. It is unusual because it's a private foundation that runs this operation. It's called the Ocean Exploration Trust. And this is something that was created by Robert Ballard, whose claim to fame was the discovery of the Titanic. And he has great interest in exploring the ocean. And he started a foundation, and they purchased this ship and fitted it with some pretty remarkable unmanned submersible capabilities and video capabilities, so that they can explore the ocean and share in real time with people on shore the discoveries that they're making. And that, and you sort of benefited from that when you stumbled on this film of the whale carcass.
Oh, it was amazing. And you got to share in the excitement of the scientists on board, but also just the fact that it was happening at that very moment underwater, and we were seeing this submersible navigate around the seafloor was phenomenal. So tell me about your area of interest, the Southern California borderlands. Where is that exactly, and why is that of interest?
Yeah, sure. So that's an area that stretches from San Diego, where I am, in Southern California, basically at the border with Mexico, north about 500 kilometers up to Santa Barbara, and then out about 250 kilometers offshore and down to depths of about 2 kilometers and more. And so this area is heavily trafficked by ships, but we actually know very little bit about what's on the bottom of the ocean there. And so we're interested in that. And actually the NOAA, National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration, put out a call for proposals to study some of these deep sea areas that haven't been well explored, especially areas like this, which are rich in certain minerals, which suggest they may be subject to future mining activity. So they wanted people to explore these areas and get a sense of what's there before any sort of commercial activities start to take place.
Why are these minerals like phosphorite and ferromanganese, why are they of interest to a marine biologist? Obviously they're mined and they're useful for commercial value, but why are they of interest to marine biologists?
Yeah, so, you know, these mining activities can have major disruptions for the ecosystems on the bottom of the ocean. And if and when this starts happening at the at the level that it may. We won't see this from the surface, but it's going to be pretty devastating for the communities that live on the bottom of the ocean. So it's important to document what's there to get baseline information so we can understand about what's there and what may happen after these activities occur. But from my perspective, so I'm a marine microbiologist, and I'm interested in microbes that live in the ocean that make things called natural products. And these are small organic molecules that are of interest to us because they're actually the source of many of the medicines that we use today, antibiotics, anti-cancer agents, these types of things. And microbes in the ocean are a potentially rich and new source of molecules that haven't been discovered yet. And so from my perspective, as we're documenting biodiversity in these habitats to see what's there in a baseline sort of sense, we also want an understanding of the what we'll call biopharmaceutical potential. Okay, so what's the potential of these organisms to make new drugs, and what could be lost if these habitats are disturbed in the future?
So what sort of microorganisms are you likely to come across at the Southern California borderlands?
Yeah, so we're in particularly are interested in bacteria because they, of course, have made lots of interesting natural products in the past, but there are many other types as well. There are fungi and other types of micro eukaryotes that could be interesting from this perspective. And I'll say I also collaborate on this project with a deep sea benthic ecologist, another professor at my institution named Lisa Levin. And she's an expert on sort of the bigger things, the invertebrates that live there. So she's helping to document the invertebrate communities. I'm looking at the microbial communities. And interestingly, a lot of these invertebrates actually have microbial symbionts that live with them. And in some cases, these microbes actually make molecules that help are involved in the symbiosis that may, say, defend the host organism from infection. Producing a natural biotic, an antibiotic in nature that functions in a way that we might be able to capitalize at some point in the future.
What sort of invertebrates are you talking about so people can visualize that in their mind?
Yeah, that's an important consideration. So if you think about it, some invertebrates like a crab or a clam or a sea urchin, they have spines or shells or claws, and they have obvious structural defenses, right? And so these organisms are not particularly interesting for us for a natural product perspective because they're structurally defended, right? It's the things that don't have structural defenses like sponges or things called ascidians, also known as sea squirts. You may have seen these at a tide pool if you poked around and you saw a little jet of water shoot out. These are invertebrates called sea squirts that don't have structural defenses, but these organisms tend to use chemicals to defend themselves against predation. And so these are rich sources of these molecules. So these are the types of animals that we focus on with our studies.
So that's what you mean by natural products, I suppose. There's these sort of secretions or these substances that these animals release. Is it only protective? In other words, poisonous or toxic? Sort of chemicals and molecules that you're interested in, or are there others used to perhaps attract mates or lure possible prey, or is it really about the more defensive substances that you're interested in?
Yeah, so great question. That's very insightful because actually, when we think about communicating, we think about sound, right? But in the ocean, there's not a lot of organisms communicating by sound. In fact, basically all communication in the ocean is largely occurring through these organic molecules or natural products. So they're using them for defensive purposes. Yes, they're also using them to communicate with each other, to do things like you mentioned, to find prey, to avoid prey, to find mates, to find habitats where they want to settle, to communicate with each other. There's a huge amount of chemical communication going on in the ocean. And so yes, we've largely focused on molecules that tend to be toxic because those have biological activities that may, say, kill cancer cells. But it's not only those. It's other molecules that do things like are used for communicating, right? And if you can interfere with the way bacteria communicate, say, you might be able to prevent pathogens from causing disease. Okay. So there's lots of aspects to this that could be relevant to drug discovery. So broadly speaking, we're interested in all of these molecules and not only understanding their uses for us, but also understanding their functions in nature, because we can learn a lot by understanding what the organisms are actually using them for.
All right, so you sail on the Nautilus, you drop a submersible, you get one of those arms, you take a sample of some algae, some microbes, some of that interesting stuff. How do you then go about testing the natural products that these things make to see whether or not they work in medicine? I mean, surely there's thousands of different potential molecules there. How do you pick a particular one, and how do you test it against things like cancer or other types of disease?
Yeah, great question. And so there's a lot of ways to approach this. The field has changed dramatically in the last decade or so. One of the things that we're relying heavily on now is a more genetic-based approach. And so in the past, we used to have to do things like collect, say, a sponge, extract it, test the extract to see if it killed cancer cells, and move on from there. So now what we're able to do is we're able to use DNA sequencing to make an assessment of the potential for those organisms to produce something. And we can do this because we
when
know
when you say
a lot,
produce something, what do you mean? Produce
a natural product that might be of interest to us and relevant to medicine.
Right.
And so we know a lot more now about the types of genes that are involved in making these molecules. So we can collect some mud from the bottom of the ocean. We can extract the DNA from that mud, which gives us a representation of everything that's there. And we can sequence that DNA and we can scan it for genes that might be involved in making things like antibiotics. And we can say, wow, it looks like there could be some completely new antibiotics produced in these sediments. Okay, so a lot of what we were doing on this cruise on the Nautilus was a survey to look for potential. And if it looks like there's a lot of exciting potential there, then we start to target our efforts into the types of samples that have the greatest potential.
It sounds a bit like a needle in a haystack adventure, even with that understanding of the sort of things you're looking for. And I'm wondering, why don't you do it the other way? Why don't you look at the genes that you expect might create these and then fiddle something in with CRISPR and see if you can test the molecules that come out on cancer, given that you know something like this probably would kill cancer cells?
Sure. So that, again, there's a lot of people taking a lot of different approaches to this.
Right.
And there's a lot of, you know, genetic engineering going on, taking these genes and fiddling with them and trying to create new molecules that way, using approaches like CRISPR-Cas gene editing, as you suggested. And so we sort of view ourselves as the explorers, right? We want to know what's out there in nature. If we were to find something of interest, someone might take those techniques and use them later down the road to try to tinker with or get these molecules produced or changed in ways that were relevant. So we want to know what's out there in a broad sense. And then from my lab's interest, then go in and target on some specific groups and see if we can do some discovery from them.
How successful has this method been? Have bacteria or microorganisms contributed to medicine greatly over the past 50 years?
Yeah. So there's about a dozen drugs on the market right now that are of marine origin. Most of those are from, again, these soft-bodied organisms like sponges or sea squirts. And most of them are for the treatment of cancer. There's a company in Spain called PharmaMar, which has really made a major push towards trying to develop drugs from the sea, as it's sometimes called. There have been challenges with collecting enough sample in some cases, and this is could be a real limitation. And so this has this created issue in a number of for a number of lead molecules, but there have been ways to get around that using synthesis. By once you know what the structure is, then chemists can try to recreate it using synthetic methods instead of relying on the natural product. But
right, because before you used to have, you used to be able to presumably have a supply of this molecule to be able to create whatever it is that you wanted.
Yeah, yeah, you need a supply, and you're not going to get a sufficient supply from some rare animal that lives deep on the bottom of the ocean. And so we need to rely on other methods, including like the synthetic biology approaches you're talking about. If we can capture the genes and then transfer those into something that we can grow in the laboratory, we could potentially produce compound that way as well.
There is sort of a picture in one's mind when one imagines a marine biologist. I'm just wondering, for people listening at home, what exactly is the life of a marine biologist like?
Yeah. Well, the fun part is going out to sea and doing the field work. And I've had some really, been very fortunate over the course of my career to do a lot of field work, go to a lot of remote locations. There are marine labs all over the world that give you access to some pretty remote places where you can see what the ocean looked like 100 years ago before, you know, before we, a lot of the impacts have happened. But in general, most of our time spent in the lab. Right. And so for me, I'm mostly sitting at my desk writing grant proposals and papers and those sorts of things. And the students get to have the fun in the lab, actually working with the samples and doing the research. But, you know, this cruise we just went on the Nautilus, you know, we'll be working on those samples for years to come.
And during your career, as you say, you must have witnessed a big change in the oceans. How is it out there at the moment when it comes to plastics, pollution, climate change, global warming? Do you on these trips to even remote places see that we've passed a point of no return, or are you slightly more optimistic?
I wish I could say I was optimistic. it's pretty catastrophic, especially in terms of coral reefs and the level to which they've declined. They're basically gone from the United States and the Florida Keys. Those coral reefs are basically all gone. The Caribbean is, all the corals are almost lost. You know, this idea of shifting baselines where we sort of understand what we see today, but we don't put it in the perspective of what it was in the past is a real problem, and it's pretty catastrophic what's happened to the marine environment. So yeah, so hopefully we can you know, institute changes that will help stop this damage and lead to some recovery. But I think a lot of the damage that's been done is not going to be, we're not going to be able to recover from.
I know scientists like to stay out of the political stuff, but seeing as we've just seen the confirmation of the election of Joe Biden, I'm wondering, does that give you some hope that policy changes may help the plight of marine life over the next 4 years?
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't mind getting political there. I'm very happy about the outcome of the election, and I think it bodes well for the future of both our country and the planet.
Yeah. Well, here's to at least four more years. thanks very much for joining us. Really interesting speaking with you. That was Dr. Paul Jensen, professor at the Center of Marine Biotechnology and Biomedicine at Scripps. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
And you can see footage of the Nautilus expedition where they came across that whale carcass. It's actually a very calming thing to watch in today's environment, particularly if you've been homeschooling like I have, on our Twitter page. It's twitter.com/newstalkscience. As an aside, Aidan, when I say that, I'm always assuming you're putting up those links, or Simon is. Is that happening? Because if it's not, I've been literally lying to people for 10 years. There'll be more Future Proof Extra on Tuesday in the same podcast feed that you got this episode. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, Garrett Mahal, Steve Daunt, Steve McClune and Simon Keane for working on the program. We'll be back with more Future Proof next Saturday, as always. In the meantime, stay curious.